Well, my good friend Jerry Purnell, science fiction writer, and a good one, and also he's a good science writer, sends me this note. He says his old friend Sir Fred Hoyle once wrote a book called Evolution from Space, in which he postulates that intelligent design through organic molecule chains sent through space. I didn't have to specify how the design happened. He simply says that it's quite feasible that the mechanisms in place just took care of business basically on their own. We'll be back in a moment with Dr. Jeffrey Simmons and his take with his two works called Billions of Missing Links and What Darwin Didn't Know on Coast to Coast AM. Jeffrey, what do you think of the theory of Fred Hoyle that molecules sent from space might have been the intelligent design?
I don't know. I do know that you need a lot more than just the molecules. There's a famous experiment called the Urey Miller experiment that people like to bring up all the time, where they put a bunch of amino acids, which are the predecessors or the precursors for proteins, and they put it in some special soup and they gave it electric shocks like it was the Earth millions of years or billions of years ago, and tried to produce some proteins or something resembling life. And they really just came up with some goo that couldn't reproduce or protect itself or find food or even couldn't be defined as life. And so just molecules in of themselves, I don't think, is good enough. It's a big jump from that to even just to a bacteria, which is very complicated. So I don't know where life came from. I just know that life looks to me as if intelligence was behind it. And I did want to point out something, if I may, is that the people who believe in Darwin's theory, the scientific community, mm-hmm. the academic community, follow certain rules in experiments. It's four rules. You observe it, you make a hypothesis, you predict what will happen, and then you test it. And they hold their own to that rule for almost everything in science or something similar to that, except for Darwin. And Darwin can't fit that because you can never ever observe, because it was unless you get a time machine. And so they actually have a leap of faith, and almost like a religion, they have to believe that this happened way back when, because they can't prove it any more than other folks can disprove it. And but they will hold the people who are pro-intelligent design or people who just disagree with them to that rule, saying you have to follow that rule, but in fact they don't. And it's like the biggest secret around.
Well, it may be. It's still, I don't know, Jeffrey, if we're ever going to get the real answer, as even schools are fighting the real
right.
answers now.
And it's very difficult to teach what is people are defining intelligent design in school, because you're not likely to have a Muslim student who's going to be, his parents are going to be pleased with a Christian teacher teaching intelligent design, or vice versa, or a Jewish student and a Christian instructor, and how you define it and how much of it is religion. It gets to be very, very sticky and difficult, but one can teach that there's design, and we do teach there's design. I mean, I mentioned that we talk about the eyes are design, the nose design, but we also teach how the human body is designed. I mean, if you took, from the nose to the corner of the mouth, there's a triangle. From the middle of the eyes down to the edge of the mouth, is a straight line. Mm-hmm. If you go from the nose to the shoulders, a triangle. If there's all kinds of shapes. I mean, if you extend your arms straight out and you put your legs straight down, you get the Da Vinci's Vitruvian Man, and
sure.
it fits into a square.
There's symmetry everywhere.
It looks, it smells, it walks like a duck. You know, maybe it is a duck. I mean, maybe it is. And I actually, we are the ducks here in Oregon.
I would assume you would then agree that this universe is teeming with species, much like the planet, much like what we have on planet Earth?
That the universe is?
Yeah, somewhere out there.
I haven't got a clue, but it wouldn't surprise me. It wouldn't surprise me, but I haven't got a clue.
I mean, your whales might be there.
Yeah.
You know, human being type looking creatures might be there. I think whatever it is, whatever this design is, the seed or the soup, the primordial soup, it's the same.
Well, we haven't found that blue marble yet, but there's billions and billions of opportunities out there that we can't see, and who knows what's to come. I mean, it's all speculation. I mean, it's interesting that you say that, because the SETI project, where they want to find intelligent design, mm-hmm. and they got all excited about, I don't have it in front of me, but they got all excited about something like four letters and two numbers in a row, as if that represented some intelligent design somewhere in the remote universe. But you look at the human body, and that doesn't represent intelligent design. And it doesn't make any sense to me that probably fluke combination was thought to represent intelligence. I also, while we were on break here, I pulled up my PowerPoint. I wanted to read to you one quote from Darwin. It's from The Origin of Species, Chapter 6. It's his famous book. And it's just a one line or so here. It says, long before having arrived at this part of my work, a crowd of difficulties will have occurred to the reader. Some of them are so grave that to this day I can never reflect on them without being staggered. And so, you know, I have other quotes like that too. He questions his work as he goes through it. And interesting enough also, his work has no bibliography. He even says he didn't have time to put a bibliography in it. He doesn't give credit to anybody for the thoughts that he has, and when in fact he copied a lot of his thoughts from his grandfather, and his grandfather had a book published about 50 years before that, and he doesn't talk about that at all. And he talks, I mean, I could flip through my PowerPoints and read you one, but I don't need to. I don't. Well, if you want, I can. I'll give you an example here in a second. But he wouldn't get away with that in the scientific community now to not have a bibliography, but yet have all these fantastic things.
If you were running a school district, what would you do right now? Would you teach this?
Well, you know, it's such an inflammatory issue. I personally think we're teaching intelligent design in school anyway. We're just not calling it that. We're saying it's nature. But I think we're teaching there is design there, and we're just avoiding the religious question. To force intelligent design into school, given the climate that we're in these days, is asking for an awful lot of conflict and a lot of confusion as to what it is and what's going to transpire. And I just don't see that changing in the foreseeable future. But what I would like to see in the school districts, if I were running the show, is that they would, like any scientific theory, allow people to question how this happened and how do you explain that? What came before it? You know, say we don't know. I mean, rather than just be dogmatic and say Darwin's theory is correct, we're just missing a few things. I view it, another visual that I give is it's the Niagara Falls of intermediate species that are missing, and these academic institutions are like security guards standing around the edge of it, not letting you see all this huge amount of material. There's something like 30,000 journal articles on just the human genomic project, our genes. 30,000. You can't even read all those. Who could read them? Who could even know? You know, there's like a billion articles on Google that are scientific. There's so much data out there that it's just overwhelming. And a lot of it is, the precedence for it is just totally unexplained. But there's interesting stuff. You know, the new Newsweek, you were talking about news. Did you see the this week's Newsweek where it has on the cover the evolution revolution?
Yes.
That was fascinating. Sometimes Newsweek and Time, I think, don't give the other side a fair hearing. But this was a fairly decent article, and it talked about the problems with finding man's predecessors going back, and all the people, the Homo erectus and the Homo habilis, and I know most of the listeners, including myself, don't know half these names, but they're all out, including the Neanderthal man. And it's been proven genetically that we're not descendants from any of these folks. And they're kind of at a loss now as to who our predecessors were, but the best guess is it was a small tribe in Africa of about 4,000 or 6,000 people about 60,000 years ago, and then all these other groups went on to die. It's sort of like a tree with the limbs chopped off, that one limb maybe kept going. And
well, so why did they die off and not
survive? Don't know. They don't know. I mean, were they combatants? Was it illness? Was they survival of the fittest? They don't know, but they've been able to show relatively well that these were not our ancestors. Not only that, but they've also shown that we don't come from monkeys. And they say that in there. The monkeys now are our cousins rather than our grandparents. And so that we come from, according to their theory, from some ancient primate-like entity. And so it's interesting. That's changing. But they're willing to admit that there's problems. And interesting enough, the person who reported this, she likened it to Mr. Potato Head. You know, well, let's try this nose on, let's try this ear on. And that was her words, not mine. I mean, if I said that about her article, it'd be pejorative. But she said it herself. But I found it very interesting. And, you know, it's funny because if there's a book called The Seven Daughters of Eve, Brian Sykes, it came out about 2-3 years ago. And he traces using DNA from mitochondria back. All of us inherit this particular DNA that hardly mutates from our mothers. So he's traced it back to seven women in Africa. And it's sort of the same type of thing, because this Newsweek article talks about the Y chromosome in men, tracing it back. And they both have come to almost the same conclusion, saying that we probably came from some very small group around 50,000 years ago. That's a major change in what they've been saying. It's the same style of stuff. I get carried away sometimes. I hope I'm not overwhelming you or the audience with just data or examples. I can take a breath.
Well, I'll get a question in or two. Don't worry about that. We've got a long time.
Yeah.
But look, you know, do you believe in time travel?
You know what? I am a science fiction nut. I love science fiction. A couple of my books were science fiction. Time Machine I've seen 3 or 4 times, but I don't really believe in it.
All right. The reason why I bring it up is if you were able to get in a time machine and travel back to the days of Darwin, and you're sitting there having dinner with good old Charlie, what would you ask him? What would you talk with him about?
Am I allowed to say I'm from the future?
Absolutely.
All right. Well, then I would probably have a conversation like we're having as to about where are there intermediates and how do you explain the complexities. And you didn't know it at your time, but we now know that the human cell is, you know, he didn't know anything about the human cell. The human cell has, you know, these 6 billion nucleic acids and 5 million types of proteins and on and on and on. And how would you be able to put that together with what you're saying? And I think he'd be really stuck for an answer. I mean, it'd be like an extraterrestrial showing up, and it would blow his mind.
Would he be interested with what you were saying, or would he toss his drink in your face?
Wow. To me, I get the feeling he was kind of bitter in the latter part of his life, and maybe I'm wrong. And so I think it depended on what time of his life I arrived there. He wrote The Origin of Species long before it was published, and he hesitated to publish it because his wife was very religious, and he didn't want to put it out there. And then Russell Wallace, I forget the exact name, was going to come up with the same theory, and Darwin got wind of it, and so he immediately got his out there. And so he was thinking this, writing this long before it showed up, and then found some pressure to put it out. I don't know how he would react. I would love to go back and talk to him. I'd love to go back and talk to a lot of folks. I'd love to go 100 years ahead, too, and take a peek.
How'd you like to go back and talk to the intelligent designer?
Ah. Yeah, well, that'd be interesting, wouldn't it?
That would be fascinating.
Yeah, it's such a polarizing issue. It's really a shame, because there are reasonable reasons to argue or debate Darwin's theories without bringing in other agendas. But it's quite difficult.
Why is it so heated? Is it because of the religious aspect?
I can give you a bunch of guesses. I mean, among the guesses, among the things that people say are some folks do not want to be accountable. And so by admitting there's a God, they have to become accountable. That's one issue. Sometimes they talk about just people who believe in God are foolish people, and I don't want to be like them. You know, they just follow the leader, and religion's the panacea, and it's like a narcotic. You hear those words, and I'm a lot smarter than that. Some people will say, a little milder, saying, just because you don't know, you can't say it's God. And I had mentioned early on, that's not totally unreasonable.
So are you saying, though, that intelligent design, that theory, mm-hmm. is a theory that we were created by God, but with a scientific twist, as opposed to creationism,
right.
which is we were created by God with a biblical twist.
Right.
That's the difference.
Yeah, I think if you...
Doesn't it get to the same answer?
The bottom line is the intelligent designer is God. But intelligent design belongs to all religions, and intelligent design belongs to non-religions. I think it belongs to science as well. And so it's not just creationists, because creationists is really kind of the 7 days in the book of Genesis.
All right, Jeffrey, if we accept the design, the intelligent design theory,
yeah.
then how did it start? How did that designer start?
I'll tell you, that's beyond me. I have no clue. But I'll tell you, that's just as big a leap of faith as the saying, this pinpoint that weighs more than anything we've ever heard of, exploded 16 billion years ago.
I agree.
Yeah, who made it explode, and what happened before that? I mean, they're both
a difficult time with the Big Bang Theory.
They're both leaps of faith. I get a kick out of these writers, scientists, people with good names who have, it's almost like beat the clock. A couple years back, it was what happened about 10 minutes after the Big Bang, and then there was a book about 5 minutes after, and then they got down to a minute after. There's a book out right now that talks about basically how it happened, when it happened. How on earth did this person have any clue what happened? And not only that, but these planets are flying, and these suns are flying all these directions so fast that the sound of this explosion hasn't even caught up to them, because it travels much slower. But I don't know how anybody could possibly know either. They're both leaps of faith. But, I'll give you an example in my profession. When I see a patient, for instance, who has pain in the right lower quadrant of their abdomen.
Well, that's right. I got to keep remembering you're a medical doctor.
Yeah, I'm a doctor. I take 2 aspirin. Anyway, they got the pain in the right lower quadrant, and they've got a little bit of fever, and I take a blood test, and their white count is up, and I'm poking, and there's a certain point called McBurney's point that's very tender. I can say with some surety, I believe this is appendicitis. You know, I run my test to confirm it and get a surgeon to see him. Well, in a way, it's like I'm looking at complexity, and I'm saying, you know, I've been looking at this for 40 years, and this is just such overwhelming complexity that seems to have some natural progression to it. It has organization to it. It has ways of correcting itself, repairing itself. You know, and like the heart repairs itself on the run. It beats for 70 years and repairs itself on the run. How did it do that beforehand if there was an intermediate heart? Interesting enough, let me give you another design on the human body. There is a childbirth. There is, when you're in your mom's womb, the blood passes from the left side, from the right side of the heart to the left side, because there's no reason to go through the lungs. And so you get your oxygen from the placenta, from the mom.
Right.
So the minute you're born, the right and left side close off. I mean, it's there could not have been an in-between where you still had the blood going through the heart and not through the lungs. And so not only do you take a breath at exactly the right time, in fact, my Billions of Missing Links, the very first 3 pages talks about childbirth. And when the child is ready to be born, it actually sends a hormone to the mom. And I'll tell you about it when we come back.
All right, Jeffrey, we'll be back. And we'll be back with Dr. Jeffrey Simmons as we continue to talk about his thoughts, his theories with his book, Billions of Missing Links. That's next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast with Dr. Jeffrey Simmons. Jeffrey, you were talking about the fetus.
Right.
Go ahead. I'll let you pick that back up again.
Sure. In the first few pages of my new book, I think childbirth is one of those miracles that everybody agrees is miraculous, and those who've witnessed it in particular. And so I donate the first three pages to what really happens from a physician's perspective in the physiology. So what happens is when the baby is ready, the lungs are ready now, the GI tract is ready to take food, you know, everything's ready to go. It sends a hormone to the mom's brain. It goes through the placenta to the mom and says, I'm ready. Let's get going here. And the two of them orchestrate what happens. And so hormones come out of the mom's brain and elsewhere and then start causing the contractions, shift the baby to the right position, start pushing the baby out. And the head is molded in such a way that the bones aren't fused so they can squeeze through. It's a very tight squeeze, and if it weren't for the bones not being fused, the babies would never make it out. It's very complicated, and the child can't take a breath too early or it's over, or too late. There's brain damage. And so, and 98 to 99.7% of these childbirths happen okay, and proceed in exactly the way they're supposed to. And it's so complicated, one can't fathom, I can't anyway, this is that incredulity type of argument, that there could be some intermediate delivery that happened before. And then finally, by trial and error, we got it right. We just wouldn't be here. And so if anybody's interested in the book and they want to go to the bookstore, just read those first three pages, and you will know whether you want to read my book or not, I think, from that point on.
Well, they're both books are great. We're going to talk about where you can get them in just a second. Look, the Cambrian explosion, when that occurred, we went from bacteria and algae to really multi-level organisms. What do you think happened during this period? What do you think caused the explosion?
Well, nobody knows, and I'm certainly not smarter than the folks who studied it. All we do know is that it happened. And it's incredible. And if you, there's a number of very good books with good pictures of fossils, and it's very, very interesting. But I don't know what happened. Some of the arguments from the folks who are pro-Darwin say, well, maybe the world was such that we couldn't fossilize things before them, and so that's why there aren't intermediate species. But nobody really knows what happened, why they came in such a huge number, and how they disappeared. Disease, maybe global warming, an asteroid hit. Don't know. While we're at the break, I went with my keep jumping around, but I wanted to read you another quote from Darwin. He says, this has to do with him not having a bibliography. He says, and this is again Origin Species. This is the famous piece of work. And he has one piece of work that I really like, I'll come back to, but he says, this abstract, which I now publish, must necessarily be imperfect. I cannot here give references and authorities for my several statements, and I must trust to the reader reposing some confidence in my accuracy. That would not fly in any academic institution in this country. Trust me, I do have a bibliography. I'm just not going to print it. And so it's not as scientific as some people would like you to believe.
Right. You have a fellow by the name of Dr. Stephen Meyer. He writes a quote here on one of your books.
Mm-hmm.
But he's from the Discovery Institute. He's part of the Center for Science and Culture.
Right.
What is the Discovery Institute? Is that part of Discovery, the channel, the cable channel?
No, not at all. Okay. not even close. I'm a fellow with them as of a few months ago, and it was an honor for them to ask me to belong. And these are a group of scientists, all with PhDs, or mostly with PhDs, some with double PhDs, who feel that intelligent design is responsible for what we're seeing in life. And they argue those issues on the political front. They test those issues in laboratories. And they're trying to find ways to prove to the scientific community what they believe, that intelligent design is behind what we see as life. And Steve Myers is an extremely nice, extremely well-spoken individual who, when I met him, we basically resonated. I just had a wonderful conversation a couple times now with him, and And they do other things, too, in the Seattle area. They're a think tank for environment. They're a think tank for hybrid engines. They're a think tank for beautifying the seafront in Seattle. The man who heads it up was Lieutenant Governor of Washington and a Seattle councilman. He actually was the census director, and he was an aide to Ronald Reagan in the White House. And so he's got a collection of individuals doing a variety of think tank type things, and they strive desperately to separate themselves from creationism and religion, even though some of them may have very strong beliefs aside from that. And mixed in are folks who are Jewish, and mixed in are people who are of other faiths, and it is not a faith-based organization. In fact, they have two talks coming up with Darwin versus Design, one in Knoxville, I have it in front of me, in March 25th, and one in Dallas, April 13th. And one can find it at www.darwinversusdesign.com, if you don't mind me sticking a plug in. And they get, skewered a few times here because everybody wants to put people who don't believe in Darwin in this other camp. And but this is a good group of folks. I also belong to an organization. I'm on the board of directors called Physicians and Surgeons for Scientific Integrity. Mm-hmm. And I've been invited to talk in Barcelona on this particular topic in my book. And these are doctors doubting Darwin, just like there's a list of scientists doubting Darwin. And that list is growing.
I was going to say, do you find other scientists and people in the know, they would agree with you and some of your theories?
Well, certainly in the Discovery Institute, they have something like 50 fellows and researchers, and there's no question, there's total agreement there. When you get out into the other part of the world, there's people who agree with you more quietly because their position in the academic institution might be jeopardized, their research might be jeopardized. Even when I went for PowerPoint slides, I had somebody who really liked my work, but because he provides information to schools, he could not allow me to use his material because he was fearful that he would lose his income, his livelihood. I mean, it's really a hot issue.
Next hour is going to go by quickly. I want to take a few phone calls with the listeners for you, Jeffrey. Let's go east of the Rockies. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hello, this is Henry. Can you hear me?
Yeah, Henry. Loud and clear.
Well, I'm picking up on different things of your topics that you've been covering on Coast to Coast AM. And it's just very interesting because you're a pretty smart man, it seems like, and you make connections, although you don't overtly say those how you made those connections. You say you have these premonitions that something's coming. But he was talking about how a whole slew of species of creatures did not continue on to our present time, but all of a sudden they just disappeared, they just stopped. Doesn't that connect to the idea that there was a cataclysmic event in the past, such as a great flood, and through Noah, these people and these creatures continued, as it's not so far-fetched that that could have happened, and that that may tie into something like the Horizon Project to what may still happen in the future? It seems like all your shows are connecting, even though you're not overtly coming out and saying they are connected, George Norrie, and I just want to see what he has to say about that.
Okay, very good. Jeffrey?
Well, to be honest with you, George, I don't stay up this late usually. And when I do get woken up this late, I usually go back to bed. So I'm a little short on past shows, but I have been trying to listen to your show intermittently the last couple of weeks, knowing that I was going to be on. But I can't comment on the part of your past shows connecting, but I can comment on when you look at the geological record, it looks like there's been like five or six major catastrophes and extinctions or near extinctions. The one that people are most familiar with is the dinosaurs disappearing about 65 million years ago. Mm-hmm. And the most pressing theory at this time is that an asteroid hit somewhere around the Yucatan Peninsula and set off sort of like a nuclear winter, you know, dust clouds and sun blocked out and the dinosaurs started dying off. Surely there's been, if one buys that the geological record is accurate and our dating is accurate, there clearly has been some big things that have happened. And, you know, some people might say we're headed that way too. Leakey had a book talking about where we're going. Certainly the political arena is talking about where we're going. We may be setting ourselves up for our own self-destruction with the things we're doing to our own planet. Dinosaurs didn't do that to themselves. And interesting enough, that's almost an argument for survival of the luckiest, not the survival of the fittest.
Well, that's right, being in the right place at the wrong time or right time. It all depends. All right, let's go west of the Rockies. You're on the air with us. Hi there. Hello. Well, the person is gone. Where do you get your books, by the way?
My books are everywhere. They're in Barnes & Noble. They're in Borders. You can get them on Amazon.com. You can get them anywhere mainstream. They tend to like to put them in the religious section, but other than commenting, one, Harvest House required me to say that I believed in an intelligent designer, and I don't have a problem with that, but because they're a Christian house, they wanted me at least to have that statement in there. So that statement took me off the science shelves and put me in the religious section. And so all the people I debate with in my book are all in another section of the bookstore, which really isn't fair. But interesting enough, maybe I wouldn't be selling my books.
I was going to say the religious section is pretty hot these days.
Yeah, so if I want to sell my books, I probably shouldn't complain about where they're putting them, huh?
Maybe I
would like to get, you know, an honest debate going on where people can put their agendas aside and take their fingers out of their ears and, you know, and let's talk about what's legitimate in this theory and what isn't.
I guess the problem with all of it, Jeffrey, is do we really ever know? And will we really ever know?
Well, I don't have my crystal ball in the room here with me.
That's the problem.
Yeah. I don't think we're going to know in our lifetime. Will we ever know? Yeah, I don't know. Like I said, there's some folks who, like I said, God could come down with his PowerPoint showing how he did it, and they still wouldn't buy it. So there's always going to be a problem convincing either side of the other's arguments, but we're not going to know. I don't see how we're going to know in our lifetime.
Let's go to our wild card line. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hello. My name is John.
Hi, John.
Calling from Linwood, Washington. Just to give you a quick background, I finished a biology degree about 30 years ago. And what really kicked off my thinking was the embryology courses. So I've been trying to figure out for the last 30 years what's going on. I'm wondering if Jeff agrees with what I've come up with here. A lot of people talk about when life begins in the embryo.
Right.
Well, my thinking is that life, by definition, is continuous, that you can't stop that chain of life that's been going on for hundreds of thousands of years. The seed from the mother and the father, they're both living cells, so they are alive and they meet and join their genetics,
mm-hmm.
and it's all continuous. It doesn't stop. It can't stop and come back alive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's that old theory about spontaneous generation.
Well, that's what Darwin believed.
You know, mouses out of a pile of dust or something.
The frogs came from mud and
yeah, but yeah. I'm wondering if you agree with that partially or...
Well, I certainly agree that an egg and a sperm is alive. I agree that they combine to form something that is living. And one has to be very, very careful when you get into this arena because there's some obvious agendas that start coming to the front. And I try to avoid that particular debate about when life begins and is it abortion and is it something else and things of that sort. But I do think science is changing a lot of things, in the realm of abortion. It's interesting because when I was in my training, which was a number of years ago, we were lucky if we could save a child that was 32 or 34 weeks old.
Right.
The Kennedy child died, you know, 32 or 33 weeks along. Now we're down to 24 weeks and pushing the envelope. And so it's forcing people who believe in certain political agendas to reassess some of aspects of that. certainly there's a progression from the egg, multiple stages, multiple cells. We go from this one cell to this 75 trillion cell human being, and it's one progression all the way through. And, you know, the fourth or sixth week, there's a heart beating, and there's the beginning of a brain. And
just like in the chicken studies that I had in class, this is all on a program, very predictable.
It is absolutely predictable.
You know,
it's incredibly predictable. It follows a very specific plan, and a certain size, certain things develop at certain times. We know that when women will drink alcohol at a certain time of the pregnancy, at a certain time of the child's life, can have a severe impact if it happens at a certain type of growth. Interesting enough, one of the unbelievable things that happen, there's a in the fetus, there's a time where like a quarter of a million neurons, those are nerve cells, migrate from the center part of the brain to the edges of the brain, and they all know where to go. And it's, they do this like every minute, quarter of a million of them start migrating, and they all have up to 10,000 connections. So it's almost like...
It's unbelievable.
Yeah, it's almost like everybody on this planet, and then multiply them by some 10 or 100-fold, are in constant touch with each other on an instantaneous basis. And they all go to the right house and to the right room, and they put on the right shoes. It just it boggles the mind. But, you know, it is a political thing as to when life begins in this country anyway.
West of the Rockies, you're up with us on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi. Can you guys hear me?
Yeah, we sure can.
Hi, this is Dave calling from San Diego. George, Jeffrey, thanks for having me on. It's
sure
great.
Thing, David.
The Cambrian period, to me, is the most interesting time period that's, you know, when you're talking about intelligent design. And, you know, basically just a riot of creation all of a sudden happened that, you know, basically instantaneously. And I wanted to talk about Charles P. Walcott, if you're familiar with him.
You got to give me more clue.
He was the director of the Smithsonian Institution in 1904, and he was the first one that he was collecting samples in the Burgess Pass in the Rocky Mountains.
Yeah.
And he collected over 40,000 samples, and then they basically sat in a drawer in the Smithsonian Institution until the 1980s, and then basically were rediscovered, and then in the early 90s, you know, Time magazine had that cover that was, you know, science discovers a riot of creation. And I was just wondering if you knew that story and why that information was suppressed all those years.
Well, I don't know if it was suppressed or not, but it's not uncommon to have some fossil discovered in the deep, dark shelves that is a meaningful fossil. Or a fossil is looked at again and discovered it means something else. I mean, that's what's happening with this Newsweek article about how they're looking at the skulls and seeing how the brain leaves a mark of itself on the inside of the bone. And so it's not unusual to have that kind of story happen.
All right, we'll be back with the final hour. It was kind of a tune-up for phone calls. Full hour of phone calls next on Coast to Coast AM.